This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey, listener, it's your host, Nick, here with a quick message before the show. If you enjoy this episode, learn something new, or just feel like helping us out, please consider following the show, subscribing on your favorite podcast platform, leaving us a 5-star review, or sharing this episode. All of these things greatly help the Birdshot Podcast and allow us to reach more and more listeners just like yourself. I would appreciate you taking just a minute to do any of those things. And if you really love the show and you want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, subscribing, and following, you could consider becoming a Patreon contributor, which gets you some exclusive discounts and promotions, some bonus content from time to time. You'd be eligible for any and all Patreon giveaways. And last but hopefully not least, I will send you some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you from me for your support of the show. You can learn more and sign up for that at patreon.com/birdshot or click the link in the show notes to this episode. Thank you very much for listening. And with that said, I hope you enjoy this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. All right, man, let's try this again. Welcome back to the Birdshot Podcast.
Yeah, thanks.
Jared Elm. I think, man, since the last time we spoke, Jared Elm of the Rough Grouse Society, I should say, your position has changed a little bit at the org. Are you still in the NRCS offices or no?
Yes, and I'm also now the state coordinator, so I supervise our other NRCS partner staff, partner staff with the Wisconsin DNR, and then also some of our other agreements with the Forest Service, the state, and Fish and Wildlife, and everything in between. So, yes, I'm still helping private landowners in the northwest part of the state, but also have taken on some additional duties.
So. Okay. All right. And it seems like from my following along a little bit, the conservation delivery staff, or however you guys would describe them, I mean, the team seems to be growing as far as the forest coordinators and everybody involved, because they're adding new people pretty often, it seems like.
Yeah, especially as opportunities arise. We're, I think, up to 7 conservation staff just in Wisconsin. I'm not even sure where we're at organizationally across the country. It's been a pretty steady growth model for the past, you know, really since I started with RGS 7 years ago.
So you're seven years in now.
Yep, just over 7 years. Hard to imagine. Man.
Yeah, that's good. We were just talking about the podcast and how long I've been doing that. And I don't remember when the last time you were on the show, but I do remember specifically doing an episode on Wisconsin Sharptails where we were sitting next to the tailgate on the Barrens, and which is a landscape that has to do with fire, which we'll be talking about a little bit today. But yeah, that goes back a while. And yeah, you've been in that role for quite some time as I've been doing the podcast. And like I said, great to have you back on today.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about fire and birds and hopefully everything in between.
Exactly. Well, what can you tell me about the wildfires burning to the north of me? For anybody in the area or perhaps following along, we've got, well, it was 3. I think it's down to 2 now. Wildfires burning in Grouse Country, northern Minnesota, the Jenkins Creek Fire, Camp House Fire, over 30,000 acres at this point, and they're still working on containment. It's been going on for a couple of weeks now.
Yeah, from my latest report that I got from our RGS integrated position in the Superior National Forest, it sounds like Camp House is mostly contained, and Jenkins Creek looks like contained here shortly. So hopefully they can get those put out. You know, we got some ample rain earlier this week that helped that process and get those controlled.
Yeah. Do you know off the top of your head when they did start up? I guess I don't
I could look that up, but it's been over a week at this point, I think.
Yeah, I want to say some of the first fires were detected maybe on May 11th, if I remember right, and were just a smolder at that point. But, you know, especially in some of those areas are I wouldn't say super remote, but they are fairly wet, and oftentimes our fires smolder for a while before they really explode when wind gusts come up or some other thing happens. That's somewhat typical, especially in the upper Great Lakes.
Yeah, I think I was talking to somebody this week. There's, as maybe listeners could imagine, I've been having a few listeners checked in, kind of asking about the fires and sort of about the birds and implications, and we'll get into some of that stuff. But somebody was mentioning that a few years ago we had a pretty large fire. I forget the size of that fire now, the Greenwood Lake fire. And I think somebody was saying that basically smoldered for like 4 months. I mean, it just like, and that's pretty similar terrain, a lot of lowland sort of boggy area. And I haven't been up to check out where that fire went through in the past couple of years. But yeah, like you said, they're remote areas, not extremely remote, but there are portions of where the fire is going that are just like pretty tough to access. And a lot of that sort of low boggy stuff.
Yeah, it's also in the shield country, so there's a lot of rock and boulder and other things that limit, you know, heavy machinery access.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, like, obviously you have an update from the Superior National Forest folks. I didn't really know, like, is this something that, you know, is it a constant topic of conversation amongst you and your colleagues right now, or is it sort of, you know that it's happening and there will be repercussions and property ownership and that kind of stuff as it relates to habitat and conservation, but is it something that you guys are really in tune with at the moment?
To some extent, my counterpart, Scott Johnson, who is Minnesota Conservation Coordinator, is working in a collaborative with the Superior, and one of our project areas is right on the edge of Jenkins Creek, so that has been a conversation piece of we're working on collaborative timber sales with the Forest Service, and what if they are burned up? You know, that really inhibits what we're able to do with you know, that timber sale revenue and retain receipts, et cetera. So I wouldn't say it's all-consuming by any means, but it's certainly a concern and something we talk about.
Yeah. What do you, I did start to see some things today about the budworm and dead, dying trees. What can you tell me about that? I don't really, other than a surface level knowledge of it, like, what is that? What's going on there? How big of a problem is it? And obviously it's fueling these fires.
Yeah, it's a huge problem, especially in Minnesota. You know, really what we have going on, and absence of relatively low intensity fires in our forests in the Great Lakes, is we have, you know, forest massification where some of these species that are very shade tolerant work their way in Minnesota. Balsam fir is kind of the primary species that can kind of grow in a very dense understory. Balsam is relatively short-lived, and then on top of that, as trees age, get older, we've also been in a drought cycle the past several years. They become stressed and they become vulnerable to insect damage, and budworm is kind of the primary insect that targets conifer. We also see that in our sandy areas with jack pine. So in Wisconsin, we had a relatively minor that could have been major jack pine budworm outbreak 2 years ago. We've had major jack pine budworm outbreaks in Wisconsin 4 as well. But yeah, I mean, really this mass die-off of balsam fir is really the one of the main culprits and concerns in Minnesota's forests right now as it relates to fire risk and fire hazard. In addition, we're seeing, you know, relatively dry springs that also get abnormally warm quickly. So, you know, these fires started in a period when we had some temps up into the 80s in the second week of May, which is, you know, very unseasonable too. So,
yeah, I want to put my mind right on the calendar. So yeah, they started May 11th and 12th, which was early last week. And that was, I was actually turkey hunting in Wisconsin, and it was exactly as you described, a period of, you know, really perfect fire conditions, like warm, and it wasn't super windy the days that it started, but then it was fueled later in the week, I think, by some really high winds. And, you know, where I was turkey hunting, there was a lot, the green up had happened a lot more. There's a lot more foliage, but we were still, you know, not at a point where things are very green. So, yeah, these things sparked up and started going, and they're still going, over a week later. So it's been pretty wild. The budworm, is that an invasive, insect, or is that like something that's, has that been around for a long time?
It's native, insect. Well, okay. Most of them are, I should say. There are a lot of different species of budworms, but we actually do have a lot of native insects that respond to kind of, older forest conditions or stress trees. And, you know, really it's kind of a mechanism to trigger fire for regeneration purposes. So to some extent, we do have some kind of artificial forest conditions, due to lack of fire, lack of timber harvesting. You know, there's a lot of different reasons, but sometimes these insects are nature's way of trying to right a somewhat augmented or unnatural forested condition, is kind of my viewpoint. So they are native, and they do likely have a purpose in the greater scheme of our historic fire regime. But in the modern context, it's very scary and uncontrollable, and it's hard to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that sort of dovetails in nicely with sort of the article that we'll preface a little bit and wrap that in. But I think listeners of this show, grouse hunters, bird hunters, would be familiar with, you know, forest disturbance and sort of the long-term benefits of that. But obviously with fire, there's this whole other, especially in a modern world, risking structures, and really a lot of structures have been lost. So these fires they've done a lot of damage, and at that point, it's right now it's contain and get them put out and hopefully minimize any further damage. But from a long-term perspective, there will be some regenerative effects in the forest. But right now it's the main priority is to get them put out and prevent further damage. But immediately the grouse hunter's mind goes to the forest disturbance side of things, I think, and the regeneration, what that means, like what's going to happen to a stand of balsam fir that is consumed by this fire? What does that look like moving forward?
You know, really it's a hard reset on the succession of that forest. And I'm not as familiar with some of these forest cover types as, you know, I'm based in Wisconsin, but from what I've understood from my peers and colleagues, even though it is heavy to balsam, it is a significant portion of the forest is aspen and birch, which generally are pioneer species that respond favorably to fire. And my guess would be an extremely dense and invigorated stand of aspen will work its way in. And also, we always think of aspen as like a suckering tree, or what we call a clonal species that sprouts from the roots when harvested or clear cut. But it also aggressively seeds itself naturally too. You know, lately, if you're in the upper Great Lakes, you probably had a nice, you know, yellow covering of pollen. So that is actually aspen. And then it's in the willow family. So it has, similar to cottonwood, where it has a seed that disperses in the wind, and, you know, aspen can disperse, you know, 5, 6, 7 miles in the wind. So really it's resetting that successional stage back to the earliest forest succession period, which species like aspen, birch, on sandier sites, jack pine or scrub oak would thrive in. So it'll be pretty, my guess is that it'll be pretty green in a couple years. The only downside is what we see sometimes with especially these dead balsam fir stands, is we can get fires that are too hot and cause, you know, soil issues, where, you know, historically the fires would have been a much lower fire intensity, so a lower temperature, and we can see, you know, soil scalding and other things where it there's kind of a level of sterilization that can happen in the soil. I don't think that'll be the case here, but a good example of that is for listeners that are maybe in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, kind of northwest Dasani, Grand Marais area. There's an area called Kingston Plains that was a cutover fire that burned very, very hot and is still largely unforested and has a lot of lichens and just not even a lot of grass. And the only prevailing thought is that it could have burned way too hot for the soil to persist. So anyways.
Oh, yeah, no, that's an interesting point. It seems to be a common thing that comes up with when we're talking about wildfires today, like that sort of that excess fuel load, because we, you know, put out fires or prevent fires for obvious reasons. In a modern world, sometimes you have this excess fuel buildup, and then, like you said, when a fire does come through, it's not as mild of a fire as it maybe would have been pre-settlement, and you have some of those other issues that can crop up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're also, you know, somewhat exaggerated by some of our change in forest product industry. We aren't able to utilize balsam fir as much as we were in the past. And two, we just have a lot more of it on the landscape than we did even 50 years ago.
What would be a use for balsam fir, and what's changed in the market that is not as usable to the extent of your knowledge?
It's largely used in paper production. So, balsam rarely gets large enough to be used for dimensional lumber. For folks in Upper Great Lakes, you know, balsam a lot of times gets 8 to 10 inches in diameter and kind of fizzles out. You know, to make a 2x4, you need at least a 9-inch tree, and preferably at least an 11-inch tree. So a lot of it is digested for paper, which, you know, we struggle with all species types that are utilized for paper production, or what we call, spruce, pine, fir. We just don't have the demand that we did historically for paper.
Yeah. They can make a pretty good Charlie Brown Christmas tree if you're in need of one.
Yeah, that's what we do every year. And they do, you know, they do, especially when young, have some really fantastic habitat characteristics of providing thermal cover. And so I don't want to totally, throw balsam fir under the, especially young balsam fir is fantastic cover, and any, rough grouse hunter certainly knows that. So.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, yeah, it's really going to be interesting to, again, because these fires are in areas that I frequent, it's going to be interesting to just sort of, you know, when things settle down here, I could see myself taking a drive just to go see what things look like, but then to follow along and sort of see what's, you know, watch it regenerate in real time over the next handful of years. It's a large area, that's been affected by this, and, it's, again, not something that happens very often in this matter and to this level of significance, but it's going to have some dramatic effects on the forest and the surrounding area for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a good standpoint for folks listening too, is if you really want to have a nuanced understanding of, you know, forest habitat and forest regeneration, see if there's a, you know, a fire that's happened in the past 10 years, where you're at, and take a drive through it and see how it's regenerating and the habitat characteristics that it provides to its, you know, its regenerative process. And it's really interesting to watch over the long term.
Yeah. Well, let's bring in the article that you wrote for Covers Magazine, Prescribed Burning and Forest Management in the Upper Great Lakes, which again, it's not different than a wildfire, but there's some really interesting things, I think, from a historical perspective to draw on here, and how fire used to shape this landscape and how that's a little bit different today. So if you want to jump in, and like, I'm really curious from the historical perspective, there are some reports and stuff in there about how, you know, we don't have like videos and there was no cameras from back in that time, but like people that were sort of exploring and coming through this area, you might think that it was all forest, but that wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, that's right. And it's also, there's, I think at times folks think that this was all open as well. And really the truth lies somewhere in the middle. But yeah, to your point, you know, pre-colonization, there were a lot of people in the Upper Great Lakes. Where I'm at in Spooner, the Dakota and the Sioux inhabited pretty much from the time the glaciers receded, which would have been about 11,000 years ago, was the last glaciation period. And they were prolific burners. They utilized fire intensively for a lot of practical reasons. Travel being one, it's easy to get around in a relatively open landscape. Another was the response of large grazing animals that were on the landscape. Obviously bison is what comes to mind, but even in some periods of time, there likely was mastodon and other mega grazers on the landscape. Also, a lot of edible plants respond very favorably to fire. Blueberries is probably the most popular one, but also juneberries, chokecherries, you name it, basically anything that's edible generally responds well to fire. It's kind of a wide variety of plants that were really cultivated through the use of fire, by native people. And, around, mid 1600s, the Ojibwa, started to inhabit the Upper Great Lakes. They were, also fire practitioners, probably not as intensively as the Dakota and the Sioux, but still utilized fire, but in a different way that created different forested conditions. So really when some of the initial notes started to be developed by a wide variety of folks, really starting in the late 1600s, a lot of people, those early written accounts, talk about a fairly open landscape, with scattered tree cover, largely pine and large diameter oak that are fire tolerant species. So some of our other species, like northern hardwoods, for example, like a sugar maple, can't tolerate very much fire based on their bark and other characteristics, to where the thick outer bark of like red pine or bur oak can tolerate the high level of fire. So really they documented relatively open landscape with scatterings of trees, but what they also documented were in certain areas, especially in areas with, what I kind of call fire shadows. So, when a fire burns, it burns with the prevailing wind. But if it hits a large lake, a large river, some other characteristic that would probably either not burn or burn relatively, non-intensively. So it would probably have less, killing on the trees that are there. So they also documented patches of hardwood, patches of young aspen, birch, and really maybe what we would think of as more young forest habitat. And then into that, sometimes, especially on certain slopes and other characteristics, they would find what we think of as a mature hardwood forest as well. So really they did document a lot of open land, but they also documented really all stages of forest succession created through patchiness of these large landscape scale fire and burning activities.
Yeah. When you say fire shadow, I'm trying to visualize that. So like if you have fires burning, say north to south, and it comes out and burns right to the north edge of a lake, then on that south side, like, would you have remnant stuff that didn't get touched or burned? Is that kind of what you mean by a fire shadow?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, I mean, it'd take a while for that fire, unless it was burning super hot and like some type of canopy fire, which if it was relatively sparsely forested, would likely not be happening. It'd be a ground fire, a grass fire. And it would take a while when it burned around that body of water to reconnect with, itself on the south end. It's really apparent in parts of like the Dakotas, where you have like a cottonwood grove on the southeast side of a wetland or a lake, just from a prevailing fire standpoint. So you get these huge cottonwoods and bur oaks and other things in those areas that the prevailing generally north wind fires just can't burn up.
Yeah, and so you would have those basically ancient trees there in those little protected pockets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's So I know you kind of co-wrote this with John and maybe some others involved. So I don't know how much like of the research and digging in, but like I'm just out of curiosity, like where did you go to find some of those reports? Is that like, does like the Forest Service have some of that stuff, like those physical or those eyewitness accounts and stuff? You weaved a couple of into the articles, which I thought was really interesting.
It's a lot of different things. There's a lot of really interesting fire research going on in the state right now. So some of it's ripped off from other professors that are studying this. One is Jed Mounier with UW-Madison has been doing a lot of work on Red Pine Fire. John Steigerwald, our Forest Conservation Director, did his master's work on Red Pine Fire frequency. And then, too, there's some really interesting research from Professor Evan Larson on fire frequency at the boundary waters from a cultural perspective. And then on top of that, too, we have really a lot of it is notes pulled from original GLO survey of Wisconsin between 1827 to 1854 when the Jeffersonian grid was instituted and Wisconsin was surveyed. And those surveyors took really detailed notes on vegetation. And then they also had to mark, you know, corner trees for each township and section. And so we use basically some of their notes of what they use for corner trees or witness trees and other things. And really we're trying to piece together the traditional ecological knowledge of fire and what this landscape looked like when, you know, basically we lost that knowledge through colonization and fire suppression. So we're really in a period of learning. And, you know, even, you know, some of the big names that we think about, Aldo Leopold wrote heavily about fire-adapted landscapes. You know, he's friends with Herbert Stoddard, really a pioneer in quail conservation in the Southeast. There's some really interesting stuff by Bud Heinzelman, who did a lot of research in the Boundary Waters area on fire ecology. So really, we're just trying to piece together whatever accounts we can find and just trying to listen to folks that have been studying it and then trying to figure out how to apply it to our modern landscape is really the difficult part.
Yeah, there are certainly challenges about that. You've got a pretty good grasp on it. You were kind of modest when I was asking you about the article and some of the stuff. But yeah, it sounds like you've done some digging in on this.
Yeah, I find it personally fascinating. And really, fire is so interwoven with the history of the Upper Great Lakes that even if you're not a conservationist, it's just so pivotal to really the past 200 years of history in the Upper Great Lakes. So it's just fascinating.
Yeah. Okay, so from a prescribed burning perspective, I've got a friend, he's been on the show before, he's a forester in Wisconsin, and I know that they do some prescribed burns over there. I don't know if they're strictly related to the Barrens, or is there prescribed burning that happens around here on the forested part of the landscape?
There is, especially for purposes of oak regeneration and also sometimes trying to mimic natural red pine regeneration where we're suppressing some of the other species I mentioned earlier that are not as fire tolerant like balsam fir or red maple. There is, but it's at a relatively small scale just because it's so difficult to pull it off in a modern lens, and two, we're just trying to also, with the resources available by our public agencies and other folks, to just maintain the fire-adapted landscapes that we've been able to hold on to as well. So it's a tool that is utilized, but it's, you know, it's nowhere probably near the scale that some of these landscapes need, but we also have to be practical on what tools we have and what capabilities we have too.
Yeah. Okay. So, and certainly on this show, we've talked a lot about over the years about obviously mimicking forest disturbances with things like forestry and logging and that sort of thing. What are some of the differences, say you've got 40 acres and you cut it to regenerate aspen versus if you could, in a perfect world, if you could burn it to regenerate aspen, that aspen stand, what are some differences that come up between just logging to mimic a disturbance versus an actual fire that could recreate that natural disturbance?
That's a good question. Going back to some of the original, witness tree surveyors notes, they really didn't document a lot of large diameter aspen, but they did frequently document patches of it, kind of small groves. Or it's also so hard to determine what a patch was when they were surveying an entire state.
Right.
Patch to us might be a few acres in size. A patch to a surveyor might have been, half of a township or whatever.
Yeah.
But, so I think that, really, I don't think there was a lot of, I think there was quite a bit of aspen on the landscape, not mature aspen. But to get back to your question on how that might vary, I think the main thing is patchiness that fire creates. So it kind of hits, fire when it moves through a stand doesn't move through like, a hot saw or a timber processor does, where it moves through in a very organized way. So it creates a lot of inherent patchiness where there might be pockets here and there where trees are retained or overstory trees are not killed, to where generally when we go into a stand for an aspen harvest, we remove most of the trees and we have some green tree retention. But if a fire were to move through a 40 acre stand, there's very likely that there would be areas where maybe there's a little wetland and it didn't burn a couple acres of that stand, or it left a little pocket of oak that were not impacted by the fire due to their characteristic of generally being fire tolerant. So it would have just been much more inherently patchy. And then when you kind of apply that to beyond that 40 acre stand to a landscape, you kind of start to get this idea of, there are probably areas that were really intensively burned where there's very little left, or what we call, grassland or barrens in the upper Great Lakes. And then there are probably areas that maybe half the trees were killed. Then there may be areas that really, maybe it was just a ground fire where very few trees were killed. So really it's that inherent patchiness of fire that's really different from, modern conventional timber harvesting.
Mother Nature is pretty good at what she does.
Yeah, and we try to replicate those things through timber harvesting. And I think it's at times something that, we really need to think like a fire more in some of our timber harvest strategies, and try to kind of find a balance between some of the ecological services we're trying to achieve, but also maintaining, commercial viability and trying to maintain an active forest products industry too. So we really need to think like a fire a little more at times, but it's an imperfect tool as well.
Yeah. As you describe it and say it out loud, it makes perfect sense. But I think it's easy to, like when somebody says wildfire, 30,000 acres burned, like your mind might jump to like, oh, it's just, leveled it like a clear cut or something. But that's very obviously not what's going to happen. You're going to have different wind currents and drafts and little wetlands, and it's going to be very imperfect and very patchy and very different, which is ultimately long-term going to create a really, really unique diversity within that fire path versus a clear cut. But like you said, I know there's shelter wood cuts and leaving the overstory and trying to do things. It seems like more and more active forestry is trying to incorporate some of those things. And obviously they do that sort of in, when they're collaborating with someone like the Rough Grouse Society, you're going to be advocating for that type of forestry.
Yeah. And I think one thing, in addition to thinking like a fire as a forester, is really important. I think the other thing we have to keep in mind is, forestry is still a relatively young profession. It's where we've really had people called foresters. That profession's about 100 years old. So there's a tremendous amount that we don't know, and we're constantly learning and evolving as well. So,
yeah. How does fire benefit rough grouse, woodcock? My mind goes right to early successional forests, something we've talked about a lot, but let's make that connection just for anybody listening that is not familiar with it or want a refresher. Like, how does fire benefit rough grouse and woodcock?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's a regenerative process. So these species are young forest dependent, is a proper term that we use. And basically, they need a very high density of relatively small stems at certain points of their life history. So, rough grouse too utilize, old forests. They use young forests. They use intermediate forests at different parts of their life. But generally, that young forest habitat is the limiting factor that's created through disturbance. I've heard the term like silver dollar size aspen is often used as, kind of where you find birds in the fall. They brood in even younger habitat much of the time where it's really kind of more brushy, but really fire puts that young forest habitat back on the landscape. And in addition, going back to the patchiness point, rough grouse also need older forests for nesting. They need older forests for, buds and snow roosting in the winter. So that patchiness of that type of disturbance really creates the habitat that that grouse in particular need, but also, woodcock and a wide host of, neotropical songbirds, snowshoe hares, you name it. I mean, oftentimes, though, when we look at our forest age class, our spread is young forest habitat is usually kind of the missing piece in a lot of forest wildlife habitat.
Yeah. So in the part of the world that you and I are in, we're lucky in that there is a relatively active forest industry, and we do see, we see lots of habitat creation. Is it from a perspective of like how much there needs to be in percentages? I know you can get into this and you're very regional specific, but in other areas of the country, you might look at the forest landscape and say, the percentage of early successional is way lower than it should be. How do you think that shakes out in this part of the world?
I'd say we're overall maintaining and doing a pretty good job in the Upper Great Lakes. There's obviously, inconsistencies within each state. Kind of the number that's often thrown around is at least 10% of the forested landscape should be early successional or young forest habitat.
Okay.
I think in some of these more disturbance-driven communities or, some of these forest types that maybe historically had more frequent fire or other disturbance regimes, that number could be higher, some could be lower, but 10% is kind of the generally what's thrown around.
And that's ultimately what I was curious about, what that benchmark number was. Do you have anything else to add there?
No, I was just going to say, that's also a plan that's often used in, Forest Service forest plans, and also like our dynamic forest restoration blocks that we utilize at Rough Grouse Society to evaluate forest habitat.
Okay. Anything else? I'm going to broaden the conversation a little bit, but anything else that you want to add on fire specifically that maybe we didn't cover yet?
I guess the one thing that I just want to throw out there is that I don't think fire is the sole answer for some of our problems that we face with forest wildlife habitat. And I don't necessarily think that timber harvest is either. I think really it's using all the tools in the toolbox. And I think we're most effective when we find the least cost alternative to manage some of these forest types. And then it's just the we have to be very practical of what we're capable of. And in some areas, it's very practical to do a timber harvest. In some areas, it's not. In some areas, it's very practical to do prescribed fire. And in some areas, it's not. So they are both tools that are equally important and often should be utilized together.
Yeah, got it. Makes sense. All right, let's take a step back again. That's a nice segue. In sort of habitat creation in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Upper Great Lakes, kind of the area that you work in. What have you guys been working on? What are some recent wins and some things that RGS has accomplished in this region?
Yeah, I think as we mentioned earlier on, is just our expansion of partnership opportunities with our federal partners at the Forest Service, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, expanding partnerships with Fish and Wildlife Service, the state agencies, and really just helping our partners build capacity and having what we call integrated positions where we're basically helping people build capacity from within their own organization. So we have people located within, you know, a Forest Service office, NRCS office, state agency offices. So we're really just, I think that's our main takeaway and our main win of, instead of us from the outside, communicating with our partners of what we think they should do, instead we've switched to a model that says we're here to help and we want to, you know, sit at the desk next to you to figure out these problems.
Yeah. Do you still do a lot of work directly with private landowners? Because I think that was a big part of your job at one point.
I do. Still do that as a big part of my job. It's probably 3/4 of my time is with private landowners. You know, that's kind of switching as things develop. And we've added some positions to make my coverage area small. If you're a private landowner in Wisconsin, go to our Rough Grouse Society Western Great Lakes staff page, and we have a coverage map of who can help you out and or get in touch with me. But we have coverage throughout most of the northern forest as well as the northern driftless area.
Awesome. What are the opportunities available to private landowners? Is it forest management plans, funding for a certain habitat project? Like, what are some of the common things that come up for a private landowner?
Yeah, I mean, really planning, everything kind of comes down to planning. So first and foremost, our staff help them, you know, with wherever they're at in their forest management planning process. So if they don't have a plan, that's obviously the first place to start. And then we also have people that have plans but are ready to implement some type of timber sale or some other habitat improvement activity. And that's where we can help folks either navigate through, you know, different programs that they're involved in, or access some of the federal Farm Bill funds that can help with certain aspects of forest management and habitat implementation, or help folks that have kind of been doing a lot of stuff but want to refine what they've been doing and develop even a longer term plan as well. So we really can help folks from, I just bought the property 2 weeks ago, to I've owned the property for 20 years. I've done, you know, 2 or 3 timber sales, and I kind of want to know where to go next. So we can help folks with the full spectrum, and then also help them plug into the different programs and funding opportunities that are available.
Awesome. Well, when you're not helping landowners and other RGS members and advocates with their property, I know you got a couple bird dogs, and you're either hunting or fishing or doing something outdoors. How was your hunting season last fall?
It was good. I feel like most people had a pretty good fall. It was kind of warm, but other than that, found a lot of birds, had a lot of fun. And, it's hard to imagine that it's almost already June and it'll be, you know, training season and hunting season again here pretty soon. So,
yeah. And okay, what are you seeing from a spring conditions perspective?
You know, I think most people can say, I think we've had about the most normal spring, at least, in the non-fire areas that we've had in quite a few years,
right,
where we've got some pretty good spring rains. We haven't had any real crazy weather events in most areas. So I think so far we're sitting pretty good. You know, I mean, really we're just about to enter kind of peak rough grouse hatch period. So there's still a lot of time left between now and the fall, but I haven't seen anything that makes me particularly concerned by any means.
Yeah, the way you describe it, like pretty normal spring, that seems like it fits. It's just, it has been like we've had a little bit of everything. We've had some warm weather, some cool weather, we've had some rain, but it does feel like, I feel like that's a decent blanket statement to make. It's been a pretty normal spring, again, outside of some of these wildfires, but I think we're in pretty good shape. It was kind of an early spring. Like, our snow was gone early, but now it just feels very spring-like, I guess.
Yeah, we didn't have a lot of snow in most areas, but we did have some snow, you know, which isn't necessarily, you know, I think we did have enough snow for snow roosting, and I don't think that we had, you know, we had a relatively mild winter, so I'm not worried about winter conditions either.
Yeah, I know that was if I had to put my finger on one thing, it would be there was one spell during the winter where it was maybe January, like before we got a decent amount of snow and we had some colder temps. Like the winter two years ago was so mild that it was like, I remember specifically like January, we didn't have an overnight low under 20 degrees, which is just ridiculous. This last winter was not quite like that. We had some cold temps and there was a couple periods of time where we didn't have a lot of snow, but then later we did for snow roosting and stuff. And I guess spring drumming counts are always a decent indicator as far as winter survival. So we'll see. I haven't heard anything mm-hmm. about those yet, and we won't for some time, but hopefully a mild, not super wet June, and we could be in good shape again this year.
Yeah. One thing I'll say with the winter we just had too, without a lot of snow, it was relatively cold and we had a good deep frost, which is generally good in the Great Lakes because we have so many timber sales that are winter only that need really good frozen ground conditions, which we got this year. So there were a lot of sales that got cut that had been, like you mentioned 2 years ago, we had relatively low frost because it was so warm. The year before that, we had really heavy snows early that prevented frost. So yep. There was a lot of winter wood cut that had been delayed for several years. So it was a great winter for logging, which from my kind of career standpoint was really fantastic to see.
Yeah, that's great. That's good news. Is that as much of a thing on private land? Like, are there private land timber sales that would be winter wood, or does that tend to be more of a public land thing?
It's both. So, loggers have to abide by our best management practices.
Sure.
Most of the mills sell what we call certified wood, where they have to abide by a certain standard of rutting and other things. So, it applies to all lands. Certain land ownerships are more restrictive of rutting and other things than others, but it applies to all lands.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's good news for 8 to 15 years down the road. We'll have some good grouse covers that we would not have otherwise had.
Yeah. And I mean, it's somewhat regional specific too. I mean, there are parts of the upper Great Lakes that are only accessible in the winter too. So when you have multiple years in a row, it's tough where you don't have favorable winters for logging.
How are the bird dogs doing? How old is Freya now?
My Vishla is 9, and then my pointer Yana is 4. So, most people say, I'm going to get one every 5 years, but I've been told I cannot get a third, but I don't know. It's pretty tempting to get another, but, both are doing really well, very active. I often get asked if my old dog is a puppy still, which she's certain, but she behaves like it, but she's getting pretty white, but she's still really fit and happy and active. So,
gosh, yeah, the time flies. Mine are 11 and 5. So we got a pretty similar gap, and I'm in the similar position. It looks very likely that there will be a puppy in my future next year, but I won't say that too loud just in case my wife's listening.
In the same boat, it sounds fun, and man, in October it's like you can never have enough, and then in February it's like, maybe 3 is more than I can handle right now. But
yeah, no doubt. But yeah, so I think the last time I saw you, you and I connected for a later season grouse hunt, and you had the pointer at that time. That must have been her first season, maybe second season. I don't know if you remember, but how's she been doing?
My first pointer, she lives up to, a lot of the, beliefs with a pointer, but she's really a fantastic grouse dog, and it's been really fun, and it's certainly a lot different than, my Vishla is a relatively close working dog, but I've found that having one of each is advantageous depending on who I'm hunting with or where I'm hunting, to kind of have a go far and find dog versus a dog that just is a very strong retriever and stays close and is very responsive to me. So, and they hunt very different, but I find that's advantageous depending on where I'm at or who I'm with. And it's been fun. Yeah. I do like the pointer. That's for sure. He's
fun. Yeah. Interesting how you can sort of tailor the hunt to the style of the dog or what you're wanting to do that day. So I could see the appeal of having a little variety like that.
Yeah. When I do travel out of state, and I'm just, I think anybody would admit that depending on where you're at in the country and what type of birds you're hunting, there are different styles and breeds and training strategies that benefit different types of hunting. So,
yeah, for sure. Now, you're from Iowa originally. Yeah, I imagine you made a trek back to the homeland last fall.
Yeah. Yep. I still do a fair amount of hunting with my friends and family in Iowa. Had a fun year. That's really where my Vizsla shines. I got her when I lived in Iowa, so that was kind of where she cut her teeth hunting. And the big running pointer sometimes doesn't necessarily work as good on some of those smaller tracts of land where you're in a bigger group. But that being said, I also go to the very southern part of the state and hunt in quail country a little bit, and that's kind of where she shines too. So,
So Vizsla pointer, possible dog number 3. Have you made any final determination on what that next dog will be yet?
I haven't. That being said, my pointer is still intact, and I, thrown that possibility around, but okay. I don't know. Have a lot of ideas, like a lot of people. I'll say I'm not. I have certain breeds that I definitely like, but I'm open to other things all the time, and I see, things that I like in a lot of different breeds, and I just have a hard time picking.
Yeah. Did you make any other traveling hunting trips at all last fall? Any new species or new experiences?
I got my first Hungarian partridge last year, which was
fun. Really?
In South Dakota. So, that was probably the main new thing. And then, one of the days I was able to get, I was there later in the year and was able to get into pheasant striptails and partridge actually all in the same walk. So that was kind of fun.
Awesome. What time of year was that?
It was in mid-November.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of have it on my list. I want to get back out to that country, sort of pheasant. I have never really been out there when pheasant season is open, and I always want to go back out for that potential mixed bag. And I know the hunting changes, especially for some of the early, like the sharptails and the huns. It's not the same kind of hunt as it is in September, but I always want to get back out there. The Hungarian partridge that you bagged, did you pick out a bird and shoot it, or did you shoot at a covey rise and get lucky?
It had bumped off of way in front of us, and I kind of had given up on it. And then my GPS collar beeped, and I crested the hill, and there they were. And it was a covey rise of partridge, but I have done quite a bit of quail hunting, so I can't say I did pick one, and that was the one.
Yeah.
So, but it was exhilarating. I'd seen them quite a bit. We actually, I've seen them on my family farm in Iowa before, but just never with a gun in my hand. So I had seen them many times. I just never actually, they just deluded me for years.
What's the status of huns in Iowa? Like, are they such that, like, is there an open season on them, or is it not like that?
Yeah, there is an open season. I forget what the bag limit is. I think it actually opens like a week before pheasant season, but they're a very, very low density and just kind of opportunistic. If you bag one, you kind of let everybody that know about
it. Okay. Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, any big plans this fall, or just getting out as much as you can and following the dogs wherever they take you?
Yeah, kind of that. I've kind of fallen into a pattern that's maybe not as exciting, where I've kind of fallen in love with a few different places that I travel to hunt that I kind of just can't bring myself to not go back to. So that's kind of what I've what I've done. So I don't really have anything new on the horizon other than just kind of keep doing what I have been doing and, yeah, enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way, but there's a lot to like about that, and we have a lot to look forward to, so it's going to be fun. All right, buddy, where should folks go to learn more about the Ruffed Grouse Society, and if they are specifically a Wisconsin landowner, you mentioned that page, where do they go?
Yeah, you can go to ruffedgrousesociety.org. Hopefully you're a member, and too, Nick mentioned an article I wrote in our Covers magazine. It's a fantastic magazine with information about what we've been doing with staff contact. But if you're interested in our Western Great Lakes work that I've talked about today, we have a Western Great Lakes conservation page on our website that also has staff contact information, and you can get in touch with me if you have questions. If you're a landowner or just want to know what we've been up to with the Forest Service and our other partners. So.
Excellent. Yeah. And I did see that that article you wrote is online, digitally available. So I will certainly drop a link to that in the show notes of this episode. They can check that out. Prescribed Burning in Forest Management in the Upper Great Lakes. Jared, I appreciate your time. As always, it was great to catch up with you and connect. And thanks for sharing a little bit about what you know about fires, both prescribed burning from a management perspective, but also on the wildfires that are currently still burning. Hopefully they're not when this episode airs, but we'll have to keep updated on that as well. But I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today, and keep up the great work, my friend.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.